Hello and welcome to the premiere episode of Gamers Without Borders. Patrick Mifflin here alongside Teresa Sammons and Lee Lam as always, and introducing a newcomer to the Smashpad staff, Kayla Owen. Go ahead and say hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
This is going to be a show dedicated to really off the beaten path of gaming. It's going to include a lot of do-it-yourself stuff, just all of the ways that you can experience conveniently the types of gaming that you're not going to access just by having the three current consoles hooked up to your TV. And there are a lot of ways to do this. I actually wrote a piece recently on Smashpad with the same title as the show as kind of an introduction to the concept. But let's get into the concept, the broader concept a little bit. So the ninth gen landscape is kind of a mess at the moment. Not only does it do the systems that are launching here next week and the week after not really have any specifically unique experiences to their credit, they don't seem to be bringing much to the table in the way of backward compatibility, which is a real problem because there's only so much shelf space on our entertainment centers, and we're and the rotational model of, you know, entertainment center management is really starting to cut us off from convenient access to some fantastic games. And so I kind of stumbled upon a few methods of getting around this in recent months, and it just completely changed my perspective about the gaming experience and really just the industry at large. So it started with a Sega Genesis Mini and a PlayStation Classic that I ended up modding because, of course, I was going to mod them. And it just felt revelatory to be sitting there playing these games that I'm not going to be playing on a PS4, PS5, or an Xbox One or Series X. Not only on my TV where it belongs, but on actual hardware produced by the platform holders. And that sort of opened my eyes to some of the possibilities. You know, you can get your foot in the door real cheap, especially with a PlayStation Classic, which is probably the best device of its kind at the moment. It's definitely the most powerful out of the mini consoles and does emulation the best. But then I wasn't really satisfied with how it handled like Sega Saturn games, and I could tell it wasn't there yet with Dreamcast, so I got a little hungrier. And I was browsing Facebook Marketplace and happened upon an Alienware Alpha for $200, which was a little more than I was wanting to spend on. You know, I was thinking about maybe an Odroid N2 Plus or something, or maybe on the lower end a Pi 4, but that's not significantly more powerful than a PlayStation Classic, so I'm glad I didn't end up going that route. And so this machine gets here and it's running Saturn games without batting an eye. It's doing Dreamcast, PS2, wonderful. And you know, I mean, it's a short list of PS2 games that it doesn't play just as well as the console itself. So that was when I started really taking it seriously. Okay, let's start talking about adding a single box to our gaming rigs that could serve the purpose of preserving our access to legacy titles. And this has been one of the most interesting, honestly fulfilling experiences I've ever had as a gamer. One of the things I'm really trying to push in the wake of this is just the entire concept of the PC, or reimagining the PC as a gaming device, not the whole PC master race thing that people seem to get hung up on, which I never really understood, but actually steering all the way into the concept of the PC as a console you know, right down to maybe finding a smaller form factor like the Alienware Alpha. Phil came up with a really good build that he contributed to the Gamers Without Borders article from a few days back, or from last week, I guess it was. And so we've got a really good foundation there in that article for anyone interested in getting into it as a starting point there. And it actually came in a little cheaper than a PS5 or Xbox Series X would. So I don't want to leave the retro minis or single board computers behind as part of regular practice, because having that $500 box is nice, but you know, there are $50 to $100 machines out there that will do quite a bit of that heavy lifting. Not all of it, but still a good share. So the idea, the long running thread going through this is going to be protecting our long-term investments in gaming. And just as a consequence of this, it's tearing down some of the old barriers to entry for imports. And oh, I've been going down that rabbit hole. Just, you know, obviously region locking is kind of a thing of the past today. And that's something I will say to the credit of the big three. They've really done a good job of just opening up the software availability to from all regions worldwide. But when you get into things like SBCs or retro minis or dedicated console PCs, then you're starting to tear down those older barriers. And that's where I got the idea for the name Gamers Without Borders as a kind of philosophy for this, because we're really universalizing the gaming experience in doing this. And one of the recurring themes of this show is just going to be exploring what some of these games are going to be, or how to, you know, stuff to look out for, stuff that might have gotten in under the radar, even if region locking had not been a thing back then. It's really, there's a huge component of making gaming a personal experience again, because it feels so homogenized these days. Like when you're playing it on the latest, greatest machines, the AAA industry feels so ubiquitous that it's like, here's a list of games every year that you are basically expected to buy and play through.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Yeah. And it'll be the same for most of them.
Uh-huh. And so I want to buck that entirely. And this goes back to one of the original concepts that I had for the Day Zero update when we started doing that show back in 2014. I want this to be a show where you might discover your next favorite game. And so that's going to be a huge deal. And I welcome everyone on this panel to really, you know, put their experiences out there and, you know, expose everyone to games that they might not have heard of otherwise. And so that's really the main thing that's got me extremely excited about this entire project. And if we can rub the industry's nose in its own arrogance in the process, so much the better. So there's our sort of overarching mission statement, if you will. Now I want to give Kayla here a chance to introduce herself to the listeners. I've known her going back about 2002, 2003, was it?
Yeah, it was about that time.
Like the second generation of GameSpot forums. And yeah, we've just known each other since then. And most recently, you've done some stuff for me on the World Warriors project, which has kind of been on hold while I've worked on more Smash Pad stuff. But yeah, now you're here with Smash Pad. And yeah, tell us a little about yourself.
Thank you. So I'm really happy to be here and be doing this. It's great to be talking about something that I'm really passionate and care about. So I've been gaming my whole life, and I grew up in Southern California in a neighborhood that had a lot of Japanese businesses, and it was really easy always to buy import games and get systems modded. And that's something I'm going to be talking about a lot, basically, is import game stores, retro game stores, and basically just like looking for good deals and basically just collecting cartridges and looking at systems and the variants of different systems. And these are all just things that I'm really passionate about and really care about, especially these days.
Yeah, and it's going to become a big thing because I think especially on the do-it-yourself and emulation end of things, to stay above board in the eyes of the law, there is that element of navigating the aftermarket. And I think that's something that will be a very strong suit for you on this show. And there's also kind of a DIY aspect to it as well with, going back to modding consoles and the lengths that we had to go to back in the day to experience imports. It's good to have someone on board that has had a lot of that experience.
Cool. Well, welcome. Yeah, I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, it's good to meet you.
And so moving on, I just wanted to take a big chunk of our first episode here to talk about our individual borderless gaming experiences, kind of what we're doing right now and what we've done in the past to kind of get outside of the the North American retail bubble and experience the broader gaming that's out there. For my part, I started, I never did a hard mod on any of my consoles, surprisingly enough. I did do a lot of like soft modding, or, you know, the PS1 had that little action replay looking thing that you jammed in the back and you put a spring in your disk drive that tricked it into thinking it was still closed when you swapped discs.
Oh, yeah.
The Sega Saturn had one of the best ones. It was just like a 5-in-1. It was an action replay, memory card, soft mod, and a few other things. It did the RAM stuff for Capcom and SNK titles. That was my big import fix back in the day, because it was a really easy mod and the games were out there. You know, it was really easy to get stuff like Dungeons and Dragons Collection or Vampire Savior or, the King of Fighters 97, stuff like that. And that really, that was when I really started taking an interest in it. Today, as I've already noted, I'm doing the retro minis. I've got, I actually finally got a hold of an NES and Super NES mini. To work on. I'll probably be doing that over Thanksgiving, working on that. And I'm doing a couple of custom PlayStation classics for people as well. And that's been a lot of fun and very educational. So yeah, and then of course the Alienware Alpha is the centerpiece. I ended up doubling down on the RAM and putting an i7 4790T in there. Damn thing still doesn't want to run Sega Rally 2006 at full speed, but that game is power hungry. GT4 is another one that doesn't quite run up to spec on the Alienware, but
always the craziest part when you do this, when you start messing with emulation, you're like, this thing came out 15, 20 years ago. Why can't I run it right?
Yeah, but then you remember the lengths that the studios went to actually squeeze them out of the PS2, and it starts making sense. But yeah, that's my current retro borderless gaming rig right now, and I just look forward to when the TurboGrafx mini hat comes down. And I mean, I've already got my multi-tap and my 5 controllers. So once we're out of the way of the pandemic, Bomberman nights are going to be a thing. I'm fucking excited about that. So how about you, Teresa?
Well, I have done some computer emulation here, everywhere, on various computers that I've had in the past. The retro minis, we've got the SNES and the NES and the
You got a hold of the Turbo Graphics recently, didn't you?
Yeah.
You can't do that here.
What? Can't find
them? SNES. NES. Phil is not here. Don't do
this. Hi, Phil.
No, we've got that. We have the Genesis one, and you know what? I think we forgot that we had it, and I think it's still in the box. And
oh, fuck.
We bought that like 3 months ago or something. What the hell?
That was about the time I got mine.
Yeah, and the TurboGrafx, like you said, Pat. We've got that one.
I should add another wave of TurboGrafx minis got shipped out. The last time I looked, they were on Amazon at MSRP, $99. So,
yeah,
I got that one in the Genesis in my closet. I just haven't hooked them up yet.
Yeah.
You got to understand, it was super hard to get a hold of a TurboGrafx mini for a long time.
Yeah, it super was.
I saw them going for like $300 on Amazon at one point. And so to see them, I got in at $130 and I felt damn lucky for the privilege. It's definitely sought after. I'm glad Konami seems to realize what they have on their hands and are supplying it accordingly. And hopefully this can get more people aware of just how great the TurboGrafx was.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut in there. Getting in on the subject of the Turbo Duo the TurboGrafx Mini. It's actually going to be part of our next segment as well. I just felt the sudden need to mention that.
Well, I've also done RetroPie and, install that on a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of SBC.
Experience. Yeah, well, yeah, but I'm not any kind of really good at it or anything. I mean, it's just follow the tutorial, you know. It's connect the dots type of thing, but an intimidating connect the dots for some people, I think it would be. And then, of course, like there's a lot of retro game packs on Steam. So I've picked up quite a few of those in the past and played those. And there's retro games like Ghost and Goblins is on mobile. So there's so many different platforms to explore. This is just like a wide open wonderland. So if you've got something, it's probably gonna play something. And and even going on like archive.org. And playing one of my guilty little pleasures is playing Oregon Trail when I'm mad at somebody or a group of somebody and
give them dysentery.
Yes. Trump has a snake bite. Oh, poor Trump.
Just somebody cuts you off in traffic. Well, guess who's going to shit themselves to death later?
The guy in the yellow Honda. Except you can't really put that many characters in there. Damn. But yeah, I guess I've done a lot of it. Although I don't always put a lot of time into it, which is the weird thing. We also have a homebrewed Wii, and I didn't do that. I have to admit that I outsourced that to... my kid, he did that.
Well, sounds like he did a great job of it, too.
He did. And then he got a hold of a 3DS from his friend. They, met on the street corner by the bridge and exchanged 3DS through the car window like it was some illegal thing. It was hysterical because the kid's parents, I'm pretty sure, didn't know what was going on.
You got the stuff, I got the money.
And I'm just sitting here thinking, oh, crap. If he bricks it, I'm going to have to buy the kid a new one. But it went all right.
That's
so
good.
Yeah. And so now he wants something that's not ours. He wants a new one so he can he's basically just gonna take the SD card and copy it. He's gonna borrow his friend's SD card and copy it, and you know, that way he doesn't have to do it all again.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that kid has every Pokemon ever that can be emulated there. And is pretty damn happy about it. I would be too. Yeah, like we have them all except Emerald. That's the only one that I'm missing. So it would be super easy for him to play them without going into the drawers and digging out the cartridges and all that. I mean, that's a huge convenience factor.
Yep.
And I think that
a recurring theme of this.
Yeah, I think that matters. I mean, it's like streaming a video instead of, you know, going into your basement onto some shelf and finding the DVD. So both ways work.
Yep.
And maybe they don't always work with, you know, whatever situation you happen to be in, but I'm glad that we have the flexibility that we have to do this.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, that's pretty much mine.
Yeah. How about you, Lee?
Oh man, I started early. The first time I ever got around to messing around with like either import games or dealing with emulation or anything was in the 16-bit era, and we were able to get pass-through carts to play different stuff.
Yeah, they were basically game genies that had a different function.
Oh right. Yeah, I forgot about those.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Yeah, so we were able to use that and do our pass-through carts, you know, to play some stuff. I remember I don't even remember what the games were that I had played, but I just remember being shocked, like, oh wow, there's this completely different set of games that are out there. The big thing I remember, like one of the Genesis games that we played, and I probably still have it in my closet, had just some girl with a sword, but it was just like, this is in another language. I don't know what this is. Therefore, this is like 300% cooler than it should be, you know?
Well, it was a good game, and it was something that was off the beaten path that anyone you talked to probably didn't even know about. So that's that personalization of your gaming experience that I was bringing up earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting as well, because that then led into a buddy of mine's brother, when the PlayStation 1 came out, wasn't doing hard mods and installing mod chips. And I remember going over with my buddy, his name was VJ. We went over to his brother's house, and which is ironically now like probably like 3 miles from where I live. I haven't really left the hood I grew up in, but he showed us Tenchu, and I was like, this is the future. This is the future. Like, and so immediately he was like, so you like, you, do you want me to mod yours? I was like, and mind you, you know, I was a teenager. It was super broke. So the idea like this guy could break my PlayStation really freaked me out. But then it was also like, yeah, we have Tenchu, but I'm also going to have a copy of Final Fantasy VII coming. And it was like, fuck. Okay. Yes. And I think I paid like $30 to get it modded. And that was like opened up everything to me, because from there, he had all kinds of import games that we got into. So we were able to play earlier, like the R4 before it came out. We were able to get a hold of different RPGs, which of course at that time felt like amazing. Even if you didn't read Japanese, like I remember when we finally saw Final Fantasy VII, not what you saw on EGM or in GamePro or anything, but like in the flesh, watching it, you're just like, holy shit. Like, this is it. And I would argue that I don't think Final Fantasy VII is nearly as good as Final Fantasy VI, but that's a different conversation. But no, that
you're
was
correct.
What, yeah. And that's what kind of opened up my eyes to like what you can do. And then that naturally progressed, you know, as different systems came out with, you know, again, just continuing to mod them And then that brought in the element of emulation. Like, here's all the cool stuff you can do with your PC. And then, you know, at, when you had like the original OG Xbox show up and people were sticking bigger hard drives in that thing, because you could make it an emulation box. And then from there, that really kind of, I just got into like tinkering with a lot of this stuff. I got into like jailbreaking my phones, rooting Android phones. And then I feel like it sort of hit critical mass with me when it came to the Dreamcast, because
well, Dreamcast rooted itself.
Yeah, well, yeah, the Dreamcast was stupidly easy to do this to, but you know, being involved in the fighting game community, just doing simple stuff like color swaps in certain games and doing custom soundtracks and all of that stuff. The fact that, you know, CVS2 never came here.
That was the game changer for me.
Yeah.
With the Dreamcast, like getting a hold of Capcom versus SNK2 when it had basically just first dropped in the arcades and we were still months and months out from the North American console release. And I'm just sitting here playing this game in my living room. Holy shit.
Yeah.
It was mind blowing.
Yeah. And it is. It's absolutely nuts. And so that was just like, oh my God, here's all the, because not only was it about playing a game that wasn't available here, but it was like, we could actually modify said game to start doing stuff. And like, we would do crazy shit out here for the final round tournaments. Like,
yep,
we modded Third Strike and we changed Chun-Li's stage music to Use a Ho by Ludacris. and like, you know, like we changed the theme song, for Marvel versus Capcom 2 from that, you know, we're going to take you for a ride. We changed it to the fucking theme song from the Jeffersons. And like, we put like different strokes on one of the X-Men levels. Like we just do not like just crazy stuff, you know?
And then, you could make as many different versions of that game as you had CDRs.
Yeah, and so that was just a blast. So you do that, and then like at the same time the PSP was out, which, you know, once that got cracked wide open, it was just the Wild West. And I remember like with that one, I actually had a friend from the fighting game community who had one of the, what do they call them, like kick batteries or whatever. I can't remember what the names of them were, but basically what would it would kick your PSP into safe mode, and that's what lets you have
it. And then, I brought one lying around somewhere. I don't think it works anymore.
Yeah, I do too. But, you know, so that was a thing. And then, of course, you know, you watch those scenes also at the same time really develop around those portable consoles, around phones, all of that stuff. So, you know, that's led me to pretty much like if I can mod a system, I'll do it. You know, just because like even sometimes, even if I don't do anything with it, I still just enjoy I enjoy the process because I know what it, you know, what it opens up. Like I modded a 3DS, my kid's 3DS, a couple of weeks back, only because he loses his games a lot. So I'm like, I'm just going to
problem solve.
Dump. Yeah. I have the ability to dump the games that you own and we're just going to stick them all on this giant SD card. And that was funny because I was thinking about doing that anyway for when we travel, because, you know, which of course we're not doing right now, but you know, in the past, like we went on vacation in February before the lockdown happened. And like him and I were carrying around like 20 games between us on the 3DS, just so we could play against each other, you know? And it's like, that would be so much easier if we didn't have to carry this around. And so that's the other thing about this that I think is interesting when we start dealing with these kinds of hacks is I feel like for a lot of these systems, it also opens up, a sense of usefulness that definitely the designers I don't think intended, but it just overall makes it more friendly. Like my main emulation machine right now isn't my PC because I work in my basement right now. I'm working virtually, which is also where my office is. And so by the time I'm done with my job, I don't want to sit in front of another computer. So I'm emulating stuff right now on my hacked Vita. And, you know, it's just with RetroArch and with the other stuff, because, you know, previously for the emulation stuff on the Vita, you really just use what was on the PSP because the Vita can run anything the PSP ran. Yep. So you would just use like Adrenaline, which is the plugin to run PSP stuff. And you just, you know, if you had a ROM set that would run, you know, under your PSP, with you know, the emulators that they had for that. That's how you did it. But like with RetroArch and making it so much cleaner, you know, that's kind of the dream, right? Like there's a better way to play this game that I would want to play on. What really at this point, there's a lot of different hardware that I can play it on. And it's kind of just, it's crazy to me that all of this happened just because really, you know, again, like having passed through carts was a thing. Cause the thing to just to go back to the original point and I'll shut up. The game that got me interested in the idea of doing anything, with foreign games, you know, something that just wasn't from America was Secret of Mana 3, you know, Seiken Densetsu 3, because it was like, here is a game that is never coming here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're never going to do it. And the same was for Bahamut Lagoon, because at the time I had finally played Final Fantasy 3, and that shit blew my mind. And it's still to this day my favorite game of all time.
And I think we've all had that experience where we got that one RPG back in the day, and you just want to inhale everything you can get a hold of in that genre.
Yeah, and the thing was is that at that point it was like Square seemed very synonymous with, you know, high production values. This stuff looks good. This stuff is fun. And especially with Final Fantasy III, you know, one of the things that I loved about it was, you know, all the little stuff in the game that you could do, the stuff that you could break, you know, if you did Vanish in X Zone. But even something as simple as if you cast Reflect on yourself, then you could bounce spells off your own party and they couldn't be blocked. You could cast Cure on something that was a zombie and it would kill it. You could cast a Phoenix down, like just that sort of interaction. That was had me like, wow, Square is really something. And then you start reading about all of these games that they had over there that'll never get released here. So between like, you know, obviously what's Trials of Mana is what it's called now. Between that, Bahamut Lagoon, and then as well as Dragon Quest V, which we never got over here for the Super Nintendo. It had been advertised, but then Enix's American branch went under. And it was like, this is why I have to start doing this stuff. This is why I'm interested in it. And then you find out you can, you know, a couple of years later, you can emulate this stuff on computer. And there are people out there that are patching these games.
Yeah, the homebrew localization scene, huge shout out to those guys.
Yeah, and it's just like, and then you can just take that to like what you see these days where people are doing ROM hacks for on older games for like simple quality of life stuff. Like there's a ROM hack for Xenogears that speeds up the dialogue. So you can just hit X.
Fuck.
You can just hit X and it'll just do the whole thing instead of doing that sort of weird stunted thing that Xenogears tries to do for dramatic effect. You know, there have been ROM hacks for like Super Mario 3D Land that have fully colorized the game and put Luigi in it. You know, like, and so you have this stuff that can go from really like small quality of life stuff to like really kind of rearranging the game, which, you know, in a lot of ways brings the modding scene to console games, which is one of the benefits of you know, being on PC is all the mods that you can access. Yep. And now you see people sort of retrofitting this to console games. And then you combine that with, you know, we're really in it in a lot of ways because of the internet. We're in this sort of borderless world and you can really kind of get your hands on anything. And, you know, Pat, you and I, a couple of weeks ago, when we were even talking about this show, it was like, I want to go play some old, you know, the old Lunar games. Like, okay, I'm going to grab them for the Vita. And you know, cause I have them in my closet, but I don't have a PlayStation 1 hooked up. And that really kind of got to the core of like why hacking this stuff and playing around with it is so fun, because I've got a closet full of games where I don't think I'll ever hook up the original hardware, just because the, you know, the displays that I have now and those kinds of things are just really kind of incompatible with the way those games run. So
take a Saturn to a 42-inch 1080p TV with the composite cables, it will look like asshole.
It absolutely does. And so that's the other thing that's cool about this is that you can play all your old stuff.
Yep.
And it's okay. It looks pretty decent with, you know, whatever you're running it on.
I mean, Panzer Dragoon's Vi looks raw as fuck, but damn if it doesn't still look good when it's running through my Alienware.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like a wide world for me, because especially now, I feel like most games don't value my time and don't respect it.
Yeah.
Particularly with the AAA stuff. And like the one thing I have to hand Microsoft is they at least seem to have, more so than any other company out right now that, has a game console, ironically, they seem to be the ones that want to kind of blur the lines for generations to where it's like, you know, we've worked on this stuff so you can play old, and it's not very many, obviously, right at this point, but old Xbox, like OG Xbox games, there's some of them you can play on current gen hardware. And they've, you know, they've really gone out of their way to update a lot of stuff so that, it, you know, you can get enhancements like Ninja Gaiden Black and Ninja Gaiden 2 on an Xbox One X look fucking incredible. Like they, and you wouldn't have that if Microsoft wasn't going, there's value in us, having these things. And the ironic part about it is Sony and Nintendo are both in a position where they could totally capitalize on that stuff. But you've watched Nintendo over the years realize that they're sitting on gold and never really do anything about it.
They can create the experiences. They can make you pay for it again. They can make you buy the games again. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the topic of protecting your investment, they're just thinking, fuck it, we already got your money.
Yeah, we got your money. Fuck you. And then Sony, what's even crazier with Sony is I would argue at this point, their bench is almost as deep as Nintendo, or when you take in all the third party stuff that's shown up on, you know, the last four generations of their systems, I would argue that they are even, they have an even deeper bench than Nintendo does. But Sony's really been like, really up until this generation, and even then it feels like their commitment to backwards compatibility is like tenuous at best. They've been pretty much like old games. Who the fuck wants to play those? And it's ironic that Microsoft is the one that's like, who has the least amount of games, but it seems to be the most interested in preserving your ability to play them.
Fuck Jim Ryan. I'm just going to get that out there.
Yeah, he can eat a big fat dick.
So how about you, Kayla? I mean, we've already gone over your background as far as, how you got into like import gaming and things of that nature. What's your current retro gaming, import gaming setup like right now?
So currently I'm fortunate enough to have a dedicated space in my house for retro gaming.
Nice.
With all of my systems connected to a CRT and everything's also connected to my capture card.
That's dedication.
Now, the retail scene in Los Angeles has changed a lot over the years, but fortunately, there's been new import game stores and new retro game stores. I actually bought a copy of Super Mario Bros. 3 for $3 at an import game store for the Famicom, and it was on discount because it was missing a label and some kid had written their math homework on it. So
is it like 1+1 equals Mario 3?
Does now.
So really, these days, I'm all about getting a good deal. When I can, I go to the import game store, which thankfully has survived the economic crisis here in LA. And I go on eBay a lot to search for things and try and find a good deal. I was ordering stuff from Japan for a while. Like I had ordered a Wonder Swan from Japan, but these days it's just too hard to get things from Japan. So you really have to be careful and look for US retailers because otherwise you're just not going to get it. And that sucks because there's some things I've been wanting to get, like a keyboard for my Famicom was the basic cartridge. I've been wanting to collect more Famicom games. But all that stuff, like the really deep cuts, are in Japan. And it's too bad because you can get a really good deal on this stuff. Like I've bought Famicom games for $1 a piece on eBay. But unless you're willing to pay really good money to have DHL ship your games, it's just not worth it right now, at least.
Yeah, it's basically the modern finder's fee.
Yeah, basically. And the import game store, they do charge a little bit of a finder's fee. But like I said, they have things that are really heavily discounted, and fortunately they also have people there to know how to fix things. Yes. So you can bring your old consoles there and get them fixed, and accessories there are really cheap too. So yeah, these days it's all about, for me, getting a authentic experience with my CRT and keeping things working and obviously got to get a great deal on things because you just can't spend tons of money on stuff and pay those outrageous finder's fees, basically.
And we're going to be talking about some of those finder's fees coming up here in the next segment as well. But yeah, that's dedication. For my part, I've definitely long since abandoned authenticity for convenience. And I'm going to just mention there's no wrong way to do this. Like, whatever you value is what you value. And if you've got the access to the setup, or you can put it together for yourself, you know, that's what we're about. It's about gaming your way, whatever way that happens to be. And so, I'm actually happy we have somebody on the panel that has, that kind of setup as well to contrast the Alienwares and the retro minis, the emulation boxes, things like that. So, I do want to take a moment here to point out that, I did verify just now that the TurboGrafx Mini has been restocked at Amazon. The restock is still going, $99. I included a link in the show notes. So for anyone who's trying to get a hold of one of those, Konami seems pretty committed to the restock now that they know that it's a license to print money, but you never know if and when they're going to dry up. So
that's the interesting part about this thing too with these retro consoles is Nintendo has been the only group that's been like, let's make these hard as fuck to find, whereas yeah. Sega and now with Konami seem to have really embraced the idea, like, you want to give us money for this, cool.
Another thing I should point out about the TurboGrafx Mini, just take a look at the list of games on this thing and then go through that list and search for them on eBay. $100 is an absolute steal for this machine, even if you don't end up modding it, even if you don't end up adding any more games to it. Just the 50-some-odd games that come with it stock probably are worth collectively going into the four figures. So keep that in mind if you're looking for value propositions for your retro minis. This is about as good as it gets. I know there are a couple of shooters on there that go for $200 or $300, by themselves. So definitely feel the need to point that out. And so another topic that I wanted to include in this episode is also relevant to the TurboGrafx, and that is Analog, one of the really great reproduction hardware manufacturers out there, has decided to take a step into the Turbo Duo waters, and they've announced the Analog Duo. It will be available next year for $200 and pretty much runs all of the things Turbo Duo. Anyone here looking to pick one of these up?
I am not, only because I plunked down money for that, whatever, the Game Boy.
Analog Pocket.
Yeah. So, no, the TurboGrafx for me was always just kind of like this thing that I always wanted to play, but I only knew one person that had it. So I just never had that much experience with it. Even with emulation, I never really messed around too much with it.
I'm hoping to fix that for you.
Well, yeah, definitely. But that was one of those things. No, I never got too much into it just because of the availability.
Yeah.
And then, as I got a little bit older, coveting something like the TurboGrafx changed into like, I want a Neo Geo.
Yeah.
And so that just kind of was how I transferred away from that. But no, that's one of the things I'm really looking forward to. I'll probably do it over Thanksgiving, is hooking up the TurboGrafx and playing it with my kid and doing some of that. And of course, I also have, I had stuff where I'd play Keith Courage and Bonk and that stuff, but never really getting into more of the deep cuts.
If you like your shmups, you're going to like the Star Soldier series.
Yeah, no, and like I said, that's definitely one of those I want to play, but I I can't say that I'm interested enough in it to purchase the analog system. That's just me, though.
Yeah, I can understand that. I have to say, it's absolutely gorgeous. Like, it's totally recognizable on site that this is a Turbo Duo that you're getting, but it is so modernized and so sleek that, you know, it almost feels like you're paying for the design alone, and the fact that it runs pretty much all Turbo Duo stuff is just the icing on the cake. It's also an FPGA instead of an emulation box, so it's actually a pretty close approximation to the hardware, and you're not going to get any emulation lag, so that's really important. It's also compatible with 8-bit DOS Bluetooth controllers or wireless controllers.
Yeah, they did that with their SNES reproduction, which I was really impressed by. I have one of those. What the fuck was that thing called? I'm looking at it right now. What is it called? Well, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. They're SNES recreation. So, yeah, the compatibility with a lot of
those analog SN, I believe.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, the compatibility with those controllers are great, and the 8-bit DOS controllers are great too.
They are.
Yeah, I stocked up on the Turbo Duo controllers once I got my Mini because, I'm definitely going to be having those Bomberman nights and Dungeon Explorer nights once we're past the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a lot about the Turbo Duo, but it should probably, you know, for those who don't know exactly what it is, it was NEC's entry into the third and fourth gen console markets. It kind of straddled the line the way the Switch does between the eighth and ninth generations. At the time, it really hung its hat on being a budget option for people who wanted still really good approximations of an arcade experience in their living room. In a way, it was like a Neo Geo, but it had an almost opposite approach to how it got there. Whereas the Neo Geo was literally the arcade board in a console. The Turbo Duo was just a pretty standard console with games that were ported really, really well. I mean, you have an 8-bit hardware that was running maybe the best version of Street Fighter II Champion Edition. And strangely enough, that didn't make its way over here, probably for regional licensing reasons. That would have been a game changer for the TurboGrafx-16, which was the standard edition of the console. In Japan, it was the PC Engine. But the problem with the Turbo Duo is that they couldn't patch the firmware updates for the CD hardware, which is where it became the Duo. It was the cartridge-based and the CD-based hardware. So they had to keep reissuing the BIOS chips that you put in the cartridge slot to run the CD-ROM. And so you ended up with like five different standards for Turbo Duo games by the time the system had run its course. In addition to the fact that NEC's North American branch completely lost the plot in terms of marketing, and they tried to, they kind of pulled an Atari Jaguar. They tried saying, this is a 16-bit hardware. No, it's an 8-bit hardware with a 16-bit graphics chip.
Yeah, and I think especially they hit this sort of weird problem in America, because at the time it was all about, you know, Nintendo does what Genesis don't, and the numbers wars were like a thing. It was really important for a lot of people. Kind of the same way that, like, even now, like, you have like PC games where it's all about, like, it's all just kind of a dick measuring contest, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we can push, or even what you're seeing with current consoles, like 12 teraflops. Like, half of y'all don't even know what that shit means. But, you know, at the time, it's like, with what was out, you knew the difference between 8 and 16 bit. And so
it was right there on the screen.
Yeah, and so it felt kind of like, you know, the Duo or the TurboGrafx in a lot of ways was faking the funk, you know, like, well, they have 16 in the name, but it's 8.
And that graphics chip did carry a load.
Oh, it did, definitely.
Like, for an 8-bit hardware that really came, at least in Japan, made it out during the 8-bit era. And I think that was part of where TurboGrafx or where NEC got their hand in the cookie jar, was because they were just late to the party in North America. And so they wanted to make some kind of statement to make themselves relevant on that front. But yeah, there was the whole messaging problem. Their marketing department screwed up at pretty much every turn, but the games that were out there were legit. And I'm glad that the TurboGrafx Mini gives you such a good slice of them. And I hope that the Analog Duo really does something to get people more exposure to them, even though as long as the TurboGrafx Mini is out there at $99.99, I don't see it being the best option for newcomers. This is really a system for people who are already invested in the platform, because there is an enormous elephant in the room here that is software availability. I said a few minutes ago that part of the Turbo Duo's identity was being a budget option that you could get a bunch of games for on the cheap and have a really good time once you got them home and playing them, compared to the, you know, pretty much having to save up for a couple months at a time to get another Super NES or Genesis game. That's no longer the case, just because the scarcity brought on by the poor North American market saturation really put everything at a premium in the year 2020. And if you want some idea of what it was like back in the day, I definitely recommend checking out the anime series High Score Girl, that probably did a better job of advertising the TurboGrafx in a couple of episodes than NEC North America did in the entire run of the, you know, the hardware cycle. But now it's not like you can run into your local indie game store and grab 5 games for $50 or so. That's a problem for Analog. But if all they're trying to do is get the system out there to people who already have their Turbo Duos that are on their last knees, that's probably where I see this serving the most purpose. But I really would love to see a full-scale resurgence of the TurboGrafx Turbo Duo brand. And so I'm really hoping that maybe Limited Run Games or someone like that could come in and cut a republishing deal to get some more of these games out there, so it's not just preaching to the choir with the consoles that are going to be going out.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing that's going to happen here too is that it feels like Analog is going for people that already own the games, and these mini systems are going for people that don't. And I feel like sort of the dividing line, you know, between the two is that the thing that Analog doesn't advertise, and I wouldn't either, is that all of their systems that they've put out become stupidly easy to actually like put ROMs on, you know, and Analog kind of just looks the other way. And they're just kind of like, well, we're not telling you what you can and can't do with the hardware.
They did specify this time around that the SD card compatibility is not for ROMs. So
yeah,
you know, plausible deniability, but
yeah, and you know that'll take all of a month for that to be cracked,
if that long.
Yeah, and so, but the reason that I bring that up is because I think that's another really important part of you know, a topic that I'm sure we'll discuss here numerous times and definitely at more length. I think now with how many generations of games that we've had, and because of how expensive some of these games are, there is a very large dividing line in video gaming that comes down to, I just want to play it and I just want to own it. You know, and there are some people that straddle that line. And then there are some people that just do one or the other, where, you see people out there that are like, I want to just get a full NES collection just so I can stare at it on my shelf. Meanwhile, there are other people that are like, this company has given me no way to pay them for this thing, so I'm just going to download it and I'm going to enjoy it. And I'm fine with both of those things. I own quite a few games that are worth a lot of money, but I own them because I wanted to own them, not because I was like, I'm going to make some money off of this. But the idea that, you know, for some of these,
the profiteers,
right. The idea though, that I could finally get rid of, cause I have been trying to scale down with the amount of games and stuff that I own, like trying to move into digital. So the idea that I could get rid of some of these things, like my copy of like Suikoden 2, for example, make a little bit of money off of it and still be able to play it is really important to me. Like I've got GameCube component cables. I don't even know what I could sell those for. I am probably never going to use them again, but I have ways to play my GameCube games that don't require the needing of, you know, of that cable or that hardware. So, and as I try to, you know, kind of get rid of that stuff, you know, I could probably at least make a little bit of money off the market, but know that I can still have access to the things that, that I want to play in some way, shape or form. And I think that's so important. I think for the longevity of the industry, especially because there's always people that are going to want to go back and play this stuff. And video games, you know, in a lot of ways were like the movie industry where they were just like, well, shit, we didn't think anybody would want to come back to this, you know?
Yep.
And so you've seen that with like losing source code and all of that stuff. So I think that's the other part of this that's important as we talk about, you know, being able to play games from different regions. You know, you have the scarcity factor that comes into that as well. And really tackling the idea of like the only reason you want to do this is because you want to play, or what, you know, what are the other reasons that you're into it for? And all of those reasons are valid, but I think having the ability to emulate and to play games from regions that aren't your own, it just makes a better environment for everybody.
Yes. You know, like,
one of the things I love about the Switch is I'm able to import games and most of them just jump right into English. Like I have like Okami. I bought a physical edition of that and you just have to switch the language in it. So I still have a physical cartridge of it. So it's not just digital. The Dragon Quest 1, 2, and 3 ports they put on the Switch.
Yep.
You can buy an Asian copy of that game and it goes straight into English the minute it's popped into your system because they're not doing any region locking.
Well, it goes straight into English. It's auto detecting your language.
Yep.
That's pretty fucking cool.
It's great, man. And so, you know, that, and that's something else that just like, again, you know, I think the other thing that you're seeing too, and we'll probably see more of, is that kind of stuff, because these game developers realize there are people that want to play this stuff that aren't necessarily in their region. And why put a wall up for that?
Yep.
Because at this point, it's not a physical limitation, right? It's not like with the Super Nintendo where there were tabs that you had to knock out with a flathead screwdriver to be able to put a Super Famicom.
You know, that era where region locking what meant having a different form factor for your cartridges.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So all of that is gone. So yeah, no, I think this is especially for older games, this is an incredible time to actually be involved, especially since it feels like for a lot of folks, at least the ones that we talk to, it seems like the industry is not doing as much for them now.
Yeah. I hope we can get past that kind of adversarial relationship between publishers and gamers to where we might have some sort of compromising business model where we get some sort of service like GOG, where you can go on there and with an account-based system buy non-proprietary ROMs that you can use however you want and actually let the publishers, let the developers get their piece while also giving us a legitimate post-standard hardware way of obtaining them without having to, you know, without having them make a major production out of it and subject it to all these shitty licensing deals that might subject them to getting delisted later on. That's a whole topic in and of itself. But it's good to dream. I've touched on this in a recent column over on SmashPad, and that's kind of my ideal of where things could go, is just having that model where you can obtain games to play and enjoy however you see fit, whether it's on a modded, you know, PlayStation Vita like you have, or a full emulation box like I do, or any other hardware option that might be out there. Kayla, I'm curious. Like, you're the one with the CRT rig, and you like the authentic hardware and everything. What's your take on the Analog Duo?
Well, I'm actually really interested in the Analog Duo, especially as somebody who likes to create YouTube videos and stream. The ability to, could I run my consoles into an Elgato capture card? And they look great mostly, but anytime you have a retro console that has HDMI, that just makes the whole thing a lot easier. So I'm pretty interested in that. I'm also interested in the Analog Pocket, because those games are really difficult to get good quality video footage from. So I would be mostly interested in getting the Analog Duo as a streaming and capturing device, which I think it would just be amazing for.
If you end up doing that, let us know, because I'm really interested in hearing your take on it. Do you have a lot of TurboGrafx, Turbo Duo games at the moment?
Not at the moment, no. I'm guessing they're probably, if I have any still, they're at my mom's. I grew up with a TurboGrafx and a Turbo Express, and my dad had a Turbo Duo, and we had a lot of games for it. We had a lot of CDs and a lot of cartridges, and so I don't remember any specifically like that I have at the moment. I just remember games that I grew up playing, like Bonk's Adventure and R-Type.
No, those are good ones. But and R-Type is one of those really scarce ones now too, I think. So good one to have on hand there. And with that, I do believe we've got a show. I just want to thank everyone for listening. Thank my colleagues here on the panel. And yeah, this episode's probably going to come in really raw, but I do think this is the start of something absolutely brilliant. And I don't see a lot of podcasts or really a lot of media outlets in general doing anything like this. So I'm excited. Anyone else have anything they want to add before we sign off?
I'm excited as you are. So I'm sure we'll be able to tweak this, and I'm looking forward to, you know, episodes in the future where we can really drill down on one specific thing, you know, whether it's a system, whether it's games that we haven't seen, or how we even just do some of this stuff. Like, you know, what's funny is I have been having a hankering to play Elevator Action 2. And like, hardly anybody remembers that game being in the arcades.
Is that the one on the Saturn?
Yeah. That shit is amazing. And it's like, it feels like a mix of Elevator Action and Rolling Thunder with two players. And
hot damn.
It's a blast. And it's one of those things, like, if you didn't have a way to play this, there's no way to play it now unless you're emulating.
Yep.
And so, yeah, just that stuff. So I'm looking forward to us being able to really just talk about this kind of stuff. And you know, again, taking what we have as far as the perspectives. But I also have to say I'm really interested in Kayla, particularly, you know, the collecting side of thing, because I think most of us at this point, especially me and Teresa, are like, fuck, we got to get rid of this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not in the fire sale mode, but I'm definitely throwing my hands up in the air in terms of further accumulation.
Yeah.
Just living in a studio apartment as I do now, and everything is about downsizing. And like, I've got my disc-based games in binders, whereas all of my actual game cases are just boxed up. And I'm going to have to really play some Tetris in my apartment about those sooner than later.
Yeah, I'm about to do that with my 3DS games. I got a bunch of those 18 card cartridge cases.
Binders. Oh, and the cases.
Yeah, and so like from back when Club Nintendo had them, I think I've got
like the big Case Logic ones.
No, I'm not going like that. But this is just for 3DS games. It's the size of a regular 3DS case, but you can fit 18 cartridges in it.
That's so pretty fucking cool.
I've got like six of those. So my plan is to go through between my DS and my 3DS games and just kind of hopefully get, and I probably still won't be able to get all of it, hopefully get most of them in those cases, because I have my 3DS games and my DS games in my closet. And so whenever I do want to get something out, I got to go grab those. So it's like, okay, what if I was thinking about you, Pat. I was like, what if I put all these things in this card case? I just alphabetize them in these 18, you know, like I said, I've got like six of them. So I don't even know what the math on that is because it's fucking 9:30 at night, but it's a lot.
It's a fucking lot of games.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but just put them all in there and then, you know, stick these things in my garage. Because I that's one of those things, particularly with Nintendo systems, I like having the physical items because Nintendo's really kind of given us the FU and the finger about being able to play this stuff going forward. And portability is still really, really important to me. Like I know I can emulate most anything on the computer that's, you know, with the 3DS, but, you know, I do most of my gaming, especially right now, because my job is just eating my brain. Like I go upstairs and I lay down on my couch and my wife is watching TV and then I play something on my DS or my Switch or whatever. So, you know, for now that's kind of my current mode of gaming. But yeah, I'm curious to see what we can do in the future. And hell, man, with the xCloud stuff too. And yeah, there's a lot of different ways to play things. And I really do feel like, besides like Steam, for example, I feel like Microsoft is the first one that's ever been like, your games, the old stuff you own, you'll still be able to own. Like, I can't do that with Sony. I definitely can't do that with Nintendo. Yeah. So, and that puts me at a weird crossroads because, like, I'm just like you, Pat. I'm like, I want to get rid of this shit. What is it? What do I have it for? If I have other ways to play it, why do I care? But then I look at the cases and I'm like, well, I kind of care.
Yeah, the only thing that doesn't really sit well with me with the Microsoft approach is the curated list thing. Yeah. I think they're putting themselves in a position where they're too beholden to licensing deals.
Yeah.
And
definitely not perfect.
I'm just hoping that eventually they say, okay, here is our blanket emulator. Not everything's going to run, but because we aren't doing this whole thing piecemeal, we aren't going to run afoul of any licensing deals. Have fun. And I'm pretty sure marketing departments across the industry would have a fit. So, yeah, with that, I guess we've got a show. Again, I want to thank everybody for being here. If you like what you're hearing, then definitely drop us a line on the SmashPad Facebook page, or I should probably mention that we do have a dedicated email for this show. It is thegamerswithoutborders, that is thegamerswithoutborders@gmail.com. And so feel free to drop any feedback on the show. And we will see you here next time.